Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns. Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
For episode 30 of the Drive Nation podcast, we've got a really good topic, I think. We're going to be talking about racetrack design and what it is that makes certain racetracks brilliant to drive around and to spectate at, and others not so great. I wish I could say that this was by design, but it's actually a total fluke. This is a really good time to be talking about racetrack design, because as this goes out, we will have just had the Eifel Grand Prix at the Nürburgring, of course, on the modern GP circuit. And there's no venue anywhere in the world that better demonstrates the difference between a characterful old racetrack, albeit a dangerous one, the Nordschleife, and their sort of less spectacular, safer modern counterparts. So that's sort of what we're getting stuck into in this podcast. But before we do that, we have got, well, a related topic to chat about quite quickly, Andrew, because you've just been driving a really quite special car on quite a cool racetrack.
Yeah, I mean, this does kind of qualify because it is, it's a car on a track, isn't it? So I've just been, I've just on my second trip of the year. Can you believe it? We're in October. But this was something I felt was well worth getting on a plane for. I went to Vallelunga, which is a very old historic racetrack just to the north of Rome. And there was the Porsche, they didn't call it 911 actually, they call it the RSR19, but the current, GTE, WEC, Ultimate 911 race car. In fact, the one I was in was the one that was racing at Le Mans only a few weeks ago. And I got quite a good go in it. So I'm feeling like a very lucky boy at the moment.
And the strange thing about that car, of course, is that unlike every other 911 before it, its engine isn't in the back.
No. I think they did it for the 2017 season, didn't they? And I thought they must have gone to the other teams and begged some kind of waiver, because you can do this. As long as the other teams agree, you can break all sorts of rules. But in fact, no, the reason it's mid-engined, it gets away with it, is because it sits, ostensibly at least, on the same platform as the Cayman and the Boxster, which are mid-engined, and it is that which allowed them to do it. And the reason they did it was very simply, when Bootsy Porsche was designing the 911 in 1963, he didn't give an awful lot of attention to the fact that one day, nearly 60 years later, somebody was going to need to run an enormous diffuser onto the back of the car to maximise the downforce from the air coming underneath the car. And so he put an engine in the way, which wasn't very convenient. And so they moved it. And now they literally flipped it 380 degrees. So the gearbox now comes out the back rather than the front. And the entire engine is ahead of the rear axle line. And where it once was is now a bloody great diffuser. So that's it. So this is the RSR19. So even compared to the RSR17, which was the first of the mid-engine racing 911s, they say this car, in terms of its component count, is 95% new. And wow. I did ask them what was left over from the road car that they could point to. And they mentioned the rear lights. And I said, oh, so the rear lights are the same. He said, no, not the rear lights, just the covers. So the plastic covers over the rear lights are the same. And he thought, he wasn't sure, the badge on the front might be the same. That's literally it. But if you want to understand just how they see it, how Porsche Motorsport see it, they don't talk of it or even describe it in their literature as being a race version of the Porsche 911. They describe it as, and I'm quoting almost literally, a single-seat racing car made compliant for FIA WEC regulations. That's how they see it. So it's a seat. They regard it as a racing car, which they just have to kind of pull and push a bit about until it kind of looks like a 911 and is therefore compliant with those regulations. So that gives you a bit of an idea of what you're taking on when you strap yourself into one of these things. And it's about as different from, if we go to the other end of the racing 911 spectrum, to the cup car, you know, the kind of cars that support the BTCC, which are fabulous things. I mean, they're really, really hairy monsters. The GTE car is just like, it's just completely different. I mean, they actually feel completely unrelated, particularly in terms of what
they
like to
drive. Is that because they are?
Well, I was thinking, well, they both got sort of flat six engines in them.
okay.
They both got Porsche badges on the front. They,
but maybe not the same Porsche badge.
But maybe not the same Porsche, but I don't know. But no, they're very, very different animals.
Wow, okay. So the thing about the cup cars is that they have no aids whatsoever. That's right, isn't it? No ABS.
Yeah, nothing at all. That's one of the things I like most about them.
And they're famously quite tricky to drive. I know you've had a go. I've never tried one, but everyone I've spoken to who has had a go tells me that they can bite.
I think I have a slightly unfair advantage in that almost all the racing I've ever done is been in historics. So I'm, you know, it's just because it's, you know, it's where I come from that, you know, I don't expect to have any kind of
assistance really.
And where I struggle is when you get into things like GT3 cars, which have, you know, all the assistance in the world. I can't get my head around the way you can muller the brakes and then just jump on the throttle and knowing that the ABS will save you on the way in and the traction will save you on the way out. So the GTE car sort of splits the difference between those because you do have traction control and you can vary that for A, its intensity, and B, its point of actuation, but you don't have ABS. So you can, you know, you could still completely ruin your tyres on an outlap and be completely stuffed for the entire stint. That said, I did, when I was in it, I just thought, okay, because they've got lights on the dash telling you when the tyres are about to lock, so it wasn't like I was going to completely torch these things. So I went down the straight at Vallelunga at, well, I mean, you get into sixth gear, and it's only got six gears, so you're going to be going quite fast. And I just decided I was going to stand on the brakes literally as hard as I could press. Didn't see a thing. Not a flicker of a light. I didn't even begin to trigger the ABS. I mean, you can at low speeds when there's no downforce on the car, because it's still got steel brakes because they're not allowed carbon ceramics. But at high speed, when it's got so much downforce leaving, there's just no way I could lock them up. I'm 6 foot 4. I'm quite a big bloke, and I couldn't do it.
That's amazing, isn't it? It's that the brake pedal pressure that you have to put into a proper racing car is staggering.
Unbelievable.
To anyone more accustomed to road cars. But the skill in braking in one of those cars, I guess like any high downforce car, is bleeding off the pedal pressure as the aero comes down.
While obviously at the same time, you know, turning into a corner. You know, these cars are, maybe I should just sort of talk you through it a bit. You know, there's always the perception, I mean, I've always had the perception that, you know, the faster and more expensive and more trick these cars get, then clearly they have to be more difficult to drive because, you know, you need better, more professional racing drivers to drive them. It's actually not true. You know, and it's not just me saying this. I would say that it's just as a thing to get in and drive fast. A cup car is a much harder car to drive than a WEC car. Now, there are reasons for that. You know, WEC cars have to do 24-hour races and they have to, you know, look after exhausted drivers. But they also have, you know, massive levels of technical sophistication and huge amounts of downforce. And downforce just makes everything easier. And it's, you know, and the way the RSR got around a track, I was saying to you, Dan, wasn't I, just before we before we started this podcast, that it felt to me sort of like halfway between a cup car and a prototype. And it really does. The way you can, you know, you were talking about bleeding off the brake pedal and getting that speed off while you're losing downforce. And, you know, you have to do that while at the same time turning into a corner, because if you're not basically braking all the way up to the apex, you're using huge amounts of time there. And, you know, the car's got so much grip, it's travelling so fast, and you're really, really wondering about, you know, whether it's really that wise to tread that hard on the pedal and then wondering how to get. But in fact, it just does it all for you. And you can really, really overthink it and probably get yourself into huge amounts of trouble. But if you just trust the car, that the car will just forgive you your own, you know, inadequacies, it'll just do it for you. And it is amazing. I mean, I've been, so the reason I'm sounding slightly hesitant is I'm just trying to work out which way I find more engaging. I mean, certainly the RSR was absolutely spectacular. You know, I can remember, just as an example, during some of the high downforce corners, because I never think about my legs when I'm driving a racing car, because why would you? But I was aware that there were these things waving around in front of me, because there's nothing to secure in the car. And, you know, I wasn't strong enough to stop, you know, in right-hand corners, you know, then heading off in one direction, and in left-hand corners, my legs sort of going back off in the other direction. And the other drivers who were in the car said the same thing. Because it's not like you're in a single seat car where your legs are down a channel. You know, they're just kind of waving around, and that gives you perhaps some impression of the forces that are on your body. And you're sitting there thinking, this is incredible. And you're thinking secretly, they're actually a bit of a driving god because you can control this thing. Until you then go and see how the pros do it, and you realize that you're not, you are the bungling amateur you always were. So there's that massively impressive approach. And then there's the cup car, which in terms of its, you know, apex speed and deceleration and that sort of thing. I mean, you know, I can remember being told in the cup car not to put more than about 40 bars worth of pressure into the brake pedal, because otherwise you'd lock them up and you'd flat spot the tires and that sort of thing. Well, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if I wasn't using double that in the RSR and not getting anywhere near the ABS. So that gives you enough. But you know, the thing about the cup car is, you know, if you are used to cars moving around on you, which I am just because of racing old cars, then actually you can have, I would say, probably more fun. It's less amazing, but you're skidding about and you're oversteering and you're understeering and you're balancing the car on the throttle and you're kind of having a hoot. You feel more involved. You feel more kind of on the stage in the thick of the action than, you know, sitting in the stalls just watching it all play out in front of you. So if I could drive one again, of course I'd get back in the RSR, because it's an RSR and it was absolutely bloody amazing. But what it isn't is just like it doesn't make those other experiences seem silly by comparison at all. It's just different. So no, very lucky boy to have done that. And if I haven't already, I'll obviously write it up on the DN Instagram page as well.
That sounds really fantastic. I'm particularly jealous of that one. So Vallelunga, just a moment on that, because we are talking about racetracks in this podcast. So what are your thoughts on that circuit?
My thoughts on that circuit is I wish they hadn't put a chicane where the fast corner is. Basically Vallelunga, you come past the pits and there's a flat left, and then there is what looks like an absolutely epic right hand corner. In fact, it is, because I've been there before in other stuff, but only road cars, and it's a monumental right, and probably very wisely there's also a chicane option, so that you can cut out the corner, and Porsche decided to exercise that option, and so we were sent through that. But, you know, these cars, they cost €1 million each. That's what, three times the price of a GT3 car, and when you drive it, you'll see why. Fair enough. But I mean, as a circuit, it's a good circuit. It's not a great circuit. It's got some nice combinations, but it's not what it isn't. It's not the open, flowing, fast circuits. That I think most people like more than any other. It's quite technical. There's, apart from that one corner, there's nothing truly high speed. The final corner coming onto the pit straight, it looks on a map quite tight, but something like the RSR is so quick that you can really feel the downforce building through there. And there's a quick chicane out the back, which is quite like the Ascari chicane at Monza. So a good circuit with lots of good history, but not one of the greatest, I would say.
So, okay, so from a driver, it begs the question, really, from a driver's point of view, what is it that makes a great circuit? And is there, can we sort of narrow it down to its essence, it's that essential factor? Is it flow? Is it rhythm?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, if I think about it not too hard, that's what I arrive at. If I think about the circuits that I love most, be it Spa, be it Goodwood, be it Silverstone, they are circuits that flow, aren't they? They are circuits which are, I mean, they're quite high-speed circuits, but they've got combinations and they don't have lots of sort of, stop, chicane, short straight, squirt, stop, chicane, short straight, squirt. So I think that's it. And the only note of hesitancy in my voice is there are some circuits which aren't like that. I have, sorry about this, but I did once race at Monaco. I think I've owned up to this once on this podcast, which is the absolute antithesis of that. And I found it spellbinding. But I don't know whether that's because it's Monaco and because I was just completely starstruck just by being there or what. But how about you? What does it for you when you get on a track?
I think it's flow and rhythm. That allows you to, for corner after corner, really feel like you're at the limit of what the car wants to do. You need some quick corners, don't you? If it's all very low speeds to switchback stuff, I think it's a bit too technical and quite frustrating. I think you do need a couple of ballsy corners as a minimum. But just thinking about what, for me, makes a great circuit. I love those tracks that head in that sort of intrepid way into the woods, that go off into the scenery.
Yeah.
I'm thinking Spa, Old Hockenheim, the Nordschleife, of course, but even Brands GP,
yes,
the full-length Brands Hatch Grand Prix track. Yeah. There's something intrepid, as I say, and adventurous about diving into the woods, not really knowing if you're going to come back. And I think it's because it's a common trope in fairy tales and parables, isn't it? Going into the woods, unsure if you'll return. There's just something about that really speaks to me, and I find it quite moving in a weird way.
This is quite profound for us, isn't it?
I know. What, should we backtrack and re-record that bit?
No, absolutely not. I'm loving it. Keep going.
I realised it when I was at the Nürburgring 24 Hours when a decade or so ago, sat in some hospitality unit, frankly, near to where the GP loop joins with the Nordschleife, and just watching the cars going up around the left and then onto the 13-mile track. And it was at night, and I was just thinking, wow, you've got 7 or 8 minutes of madness and mayhem in front of you. As watching each car going around and thinking, for the next few minutes, whoever's driving that car is going to be wired on a high alert, and I there was just something bold and brave about it, and I was sort of mesmerized by that.
I had exactly that same experience at exactly the same place when Timo Bernard in the Porsche 919 Evo smashed the old Nordschleife lap record, and he the tyres were so soft that he couldn't do a warm-up lap, so he literally drove the wrong way around the circuit for a couple of hundred yards, turned round, and then just came up past us down that sort of old connecting road, the old pit straight, and then just disappeared into the middle of nowhere in this car, aiming to do something that had never been done before. And we all collectively, figuratively, held our breath because, you know, you're not gone long before you can't hear the car anymore. And then you're just sitting there waiting, trying to hear something and wondering whether that's it or is it something going down the road or whatever. And then he's back. And it's just monumental. I mean, I completely agree with you. There is something, you know, quite romantic about doing that sort of thing, which, you know, on the old, particularly on the English airfield concrete circuits, however great they may be, like Silverstone, you just don't get, do you?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, and you've teed me up nicely there because I was going to talk about UK tracks. We're so lucky to have as many circuits as we do, but also as many really great circuits as we do here in the UK. And our tracks broadly are divided into one of two camps, aren't they? We've got airfield circuits, tracks that were built around old airfields, such as Silverstone, Castlecombe, Thruxton and Goodwood. And they have a very, very distinct character because, they originated as perimeter road tracks. And, you know, if you plot 4 or 5 points around a big airfield and draw a circle or something like a circle around them, you end up with a very, very fast flowing track. And then the other kind of circuit we have in the UK are parkland tracks, which, you know, Alton Park, Brands Hatch, Donington Park, and they have real gradient change. And they're very different in character to the airfield circuits. But I think we're just very privileged, aren't we, to have such a good selection of both types of track in the UK. And it's why racing here is so brilliant.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I'm just trying to work out which of those two types of track I prefer. I guess I'd always go for something with gradient. I love just the sort of when things go into three dimensions, because, you know, particularly when you get, you know, all those dimensions coming together at once. You know, if you think of a corner like, you know, Paddock Hill Bend at Brands Hatch, where, you know, it's a really quick corner, but you also feel like you're falling off the end of the world when you're going through it. I love that combination in a circuit. That said, I would say, you know, a really fast airfield circuit. I'm thinking, I mean, they couldn't be more different in character, but I'm thinking Goodwood and Silverstone. You know, I'm really happier in a car than when going around places like that. In fact, I was going to ask you, what is your favourite corner or your favourite combination of corners in the UK? Because I don't think I can do better than the Maggots Becketts complex at Silverstone going on to when you're using the full Grand Prix circuit. I just love the way that, A, it's all really fast. B, you have to, it's slightly slower as you go through it. So you can't just go steaming in there. You have to keep thinking. The positioning of the car is so important. The technicalities in terms of what bits of which curbs you can use. The way it will show up the limitations of your car, the way that if you make a small mistake on entry, it can compound all the way through the combination to, you know, a really big problem at exit. I mean, all these sorts of challenges, they all come together in, you know, I don't know how long you're in that combination for, but it's probably not more than sort of 10, 15 seconds. And, you know, everything I want in a racetrack is there in those few corners.
Yeah, totally. It's the obvious one almost, isn't it? Because it's such a distinctive and exciting bit of racetrack. I really like, you've mentioned it, Paddock Hill going into Druids and then down to Graham Hill. I don't know why, but somehow I'm just able to do that little sequence sort of reasonably competitively. It's hard to pick out one, though. I mean, there are so many great sequences for different reasons as well, actually. I also love the top of Anglesey, partly because, you know, you've got a really quick section into a little fiddly bit at Rocket, left-hander at the end of the fast bit of track. And then you go around the hairpin and then up through Peel. And then you pop up over the top of the circuit and you have the most amazing vista in front of you.
The best view, maybe of any circuit, is just when you go over the top there and you've just got the Irish Sea in front of you. And it's just stunning, isn't it?
It's absolutely gorgeous. On a clear day, it's beautiful. Yeah. You can see the mountains in Snowdonia. It's a really special bit of track, that. I think I've done so little at Goodwood, but I love the idea, I suppose, of the quick corners there in an old car on on cross-ply tyres. And just having spectated in the sort of TT, the RAC TT race, and just seeing the cars drift through those quick corners. And that is exactly, you know, given the chance, that's exactly the type of driving and racing I would like to be able to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole romance of the thing. I mean, it's very difficult to not be seduced by the whole thing, and that's not got actually an awful lot to do with the particular bit of tarmac that you're on. I can remember I was very lucky to do one of those sort of day-night races they do there. Where, I mean, it's not dark when you stop, but you know, you're definitely lights on. It's definitely dusk. And it was a beautiful day, and just out round the back of the circuit when you come out of Madrick and you're going down through Ford Water and into St Mary's, if you're in something quite nice which makes a nice sound, you just think, you know, I'm out here and I'm doing this, and it's a sort of pinch me moment. You just kind of, the sense of luck and privilege that you've got to have that experience, you know, whatever else you go on to do, it never leaves you. And I also, you know, I get completely wrapped up in the history and thinking about who else was, you know, went down this particular bit of tarmac, and particularly with Goodwood, because it genuinely has changed so little, that you really can think, you know, I am following in the footsteps of Jim Clark and Jackie Stewart and Sterling and, you know, and all the other gods who, you know, who went round exactly the same bit of track, probably a bit faster than you were going, but nevertheless, it's, you know, if you ever want to experience what they experienced in terms of the kind of tracks they raced on, I mean, I would say even the Nordschleife has definitely been tamed from its original form far more than Goodwood. I mean, Goodwood basically hasn't been. I mean, they've obviously done a huge amount of work with runoffs and that sort of thing, but the track is the track and it goes where it's always gone, and is all the more amazing for that.
I've done far too little driving at Goodwood, but I must try and put that right. I think how fun a circuit is to drive also depends on the car you're driving. So it's such an obvious thing to say, but it's true, isn't it? I remember doing a Caterham race at Snetterton and just not really getting on with it, because I don't love the new Snetterton circuit. It sort of turns back on itself a lot and I find it quite fiddly. When I'm in a Caterham in particular, I want to be on a fast flowing circuit, because when you get them up on their toes and you find yourself going in a gear higher than you have been previously, they're just sublime through the quick stuff. And there isn't a whole lot of that at Snetterton. But also, you know, if you're in a road car, you can get lost on a really wide, flat circuit. You know, I've driven stuff at Silverstone in road cars, and they kind of feel a little bit at sea. Whereas a track like Anglesey, somewhere a bit smaller, a bit tighter, it feels like the right sort of place for a road car.
You also get less of an impression of speed, don't you? I mean, if you were doing, you know, the difference between doing 150 miles an hour down a narrow country lane, which of course you wouldn't do, or doing that down, you know, a massive great V-bomber runway, you know, one's going to feel like about 50 miles an hour and the other's going to feel like about 300. So it's actually, in terms of your perception of speed, and which is a component of how much fun you have, you're absolutely right, the car does need to be matched to the circuit. And you know, somewhere like Silverstone and somewhere like Spa, you need a big, fast, powerful car, because otherwise it's just not going to feel that exciting.
Yeah, exactly right. Do you think, is it sort of broadly true that the older circuits are more exciting to drive?
I'm trying to think of circuits that I know that are exceptions to that rule.
And I can give you one.
Well, Anglesey's not that old, is it?
Well, that's true. That's true. Yeah.
But it's very much designed in the old school, isn't it? Okay, well, I'm really looking forward to hearing your exception. No, I think that the older circuits are the better circuits, and I'm not quite sure why that is, because you'd think, if you sat down to design a circuit from a clean sheet of paper, you'd do a better job than a circuit which just happened to pop up because that's where the roads happened to go, or that's where the airfield was or whatever, and just sort of turned up fairly random. You'd think that if you actually sat down to think about it, you'd come up with something better, but that doesn't... I wouldn't say that's been my experience. Somewhere like COTA, Circuit of the Americas. I think that's
good,
a perfect
good track.
And it is bloody amazing. So that would be my exception to the rule. What about you?
Well, it's not necessarily a racetrack, but Bilsterberg.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Which is just fantastic, isn't it? But a few people listening won't have heard of it, but it's a modern track that's gone up in Germany. I can't remember exactly where in Germany it is. But it's a proper roller coaster. It's one of these sort of driving resorts, I think, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. It's like Ascari, really, isn't it?
But
with a lot more attitude.
My God. And if you're driving something quick, and we've done a few events there, haven't we? We did 911 Turbo S a few years ago, and we did AMG GTR. Particularly if you're chasing someone who's really on it, and, you know, Bernd Schneider with Mercedes is always on it. That's the only mode he has. Around that place, you frighten yourself. It's got gradient changes. It's got really quick stuff. You plunge down really steeply at one point. It's such a cliche, but it is a roller coaster, that track.
Yeah. There's one little aspect of it, but I think it's very indicative of the entire attitude in the minds of whoever it was who designed it, which is that it actually happens on the straight. So you're barreling down the straight and you go into the braking area. And as you go into the braking area, they've put bumps in. It's not like they've just sort of turned up over the time. They've deliberately put in stuff designed to destabilize your car just when you need it to be its most stable. It's all the more nutty and completely brilliant. I tell you what, if you want to find out whether your car handles or not, my goodness, you'll find out around there, because there's everything there, isn't there? I mean, I can remember being in a GT3 RS round there and really wondering to myself whether Porsche hadn't actually kind of made it a bit too challenging. Really, really busy around there. Proper fun.
I think particularly, well, any car, you need confidence in your vehicle, don't you, for that circuit. You have to feel like the car is nailed to the track. Otherwise, you're just going to frighten yourself. So we've mentioned Bilsterberg and COTA. And do you know who designed both of those tracks?
Are you going to tell me they're both designed by the same person?
Uh-huh.
Go on.
Hermann Tilke.
Is Bilsterberg a Tilke track?
Yep.
I had no idea.
It's interesting, isn't it? But Hermann Tilke, he's one of four. Let me get this right. He's one of four circuit designers officially recognised by the FIA. But actually, he's the only, or his business is the only one that's been used to design or redesign F1 circuits recently. And he's come in for so much stick, hasn't
yeah,
he?
Because absolutely, lots of it meted up by me.
Quite. So okay, let me read.
I had no idea.
Let me read out some of his circuits: Sepang, Bahrain, Shanghai, Valencia, Marina Bay, Yas Marina, and Korea. You know, a lot of those are fairly Sochi. A lot of those are fairly uninspiring circuits, aren't they? They don't encourage great racing. They're not brilliant to spectate at or on the TV. I suspect they're not particularly exciting to drive. But then he's also done COTA and Bilsterberg. So, you know, the guy gets it. He was a racing driver himself. He's won VLN races, as far as I can tell, at the Nürburgring. So the guy clearly understands what it is that makes a circuit brilliant. But I just wonder, though, if it's, you know, the limitations of a plot of land, because all new circuits these days are built on a plot of wasteland, aren't they, rather than in the scenery like old tracks used to be. And I wonder as well if, you know, the safety requirements actually kind of neuter the circuits a little bit.
Then if you get to do someone like Bilsterberg, which is a entirely private facility where you can do presumably whatever you damn well like, then the real Hermann Tilke then emerges, and he's actually a complete fruitcake who just likes going along, who, given the choice, would design completely crazy circuits. And maybe he's had a lot of stick when in fact all he's been doing is working to, you know, a commission he's been provided, which is to provide, you know, a safe circuit, which, you know, no one's going to regard as, you know, being, I don't know, being too dangerous and is therefore going to be at risk of being shot or whatever. I don't know. Mm. Very interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And one of the people who has been very openly critical of Tilke and his designs is Jackie Stewart. And he, you know, it's interesting that it should come from him because he's such a campaigner for safety improvements in Formula One. But he is quoted as saying that they're largely carbon copies of each other, the circuits that Tilke has designed. And while Stewart sort of applauds the improvements in safety, he thinks that Tilke's designs have gone too far the other way and made the racing quite uninteresting, and they no longer penalise mistakes. And sadly, that's a common trait of modern circuits, isn't it? That they have enormous concrete runoffs, and should you get your braking wrong or your line wrong or whatever and wander off onto those runoffs, there's no penalty.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think Jackie is quite misunderstood, because I think a lot of people think that he was the bloke who took all the fun out of motor racing and everything else. But he never thought that circuits needed to be made more boring. He just, you know, but if you look back at, you know, so many of the accidents that claimed so many of his friends, you know, people like Francois Sever and Jochen Rindt, you know, those guys died at least in part because, yeah, I don't know, guardrail hadn't been properly fastened, or there was next to no runoff, or there wasn't the proper medical facilities. Nothing to do with the track itself. And, you know, I think we all think that, you know, if you run off a circuit, you know, nobody wants you to get hurt, God forbid anything worse, but, you know, you shouldn't just be able to drive back on at basically, certainly, at nothing more than perhaps a very small time penalty. So, yeah, interesting. Mm.
So we've discussed what a great circuit is from the point of view of the driver, but what about a spectator? I mean, what we want is a circuit that encourages overtaking, isn't it? That allows cars to run close to one another, as close to one another as they can. So what do we think that looks like? I suppose it's long straights into tight corners, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, so much of it is down to the design of the car, isn't it? I mean, you can design the best circuit of the world, but if you've got cars with huge amounts of downforce and unbelievable brakes, you know, you're going to have, you know, the cars are going to struggle to follow each other, and, you know, and the braking zones will be very, very short. And those two things, I think, more than anything else, prevent overtaking. So I guess from a circuit design point of view, what you don't want is a fast corner leading onto a long straight. If you're interested in Formula Racing cars, if cars are going to have lots and lots of downforce, because, you know, if you can't follow a car, somebody told me recently how far away a car has to be from the car in front before it is adversely affected by its wake. And it's such a long way. I mean, it's hundreds of yards. So if you can't follow a car through a really tight corner, then you won't be able to, sorry, through a really quick corner, you won't be able to overtake it at the end of the straight to come. So, I think you need tight corners going on to long straights going into tight corners, which sounds boring, but
yeah.
I can't think in this downforce enhanced era how else you do it. Of course, the way to do it is to get rid of the downforce, because, you know, changing the circuit and making circuits, you know, quite boring with slow corners and long straights, which is the only way you can encourage overtaking, is really symptom management, isn't it? It's a sticking plaster when your real problem is, in fact, not the circuits, but the cars that are going around them. But you need, you know, we mustn't just think that, you know, cars being interesting on tracks is all about overtaking. You need corners, you know, you need really fast corners. I mean, Lewis in quali at Spa this year, flat through Puan, pulling 5 and a bit G. You know, that to me is as interesting and spectacular and incredible to watch as, you know, any number of amazing overtaking manoeuvres. So you need corners like that. But, you know, there's a balance, isn't there? Because one of the great tragedies of Spa is that some of its greatest corners, particularly Blanchimont and Eau Rouge, are just acceleration zones now. They're not corners at all. They're extensions of the straight. And so, you know, and now, you know, Puan is flat if you're Lewis and it's quali. Well, believe me, next year it'll be flat for everybody. And the year after, you know, it won't just be in quali, it'll be in the race. And then Puan will stop becoming a corner. So, you know, We want to see cars at high speed going through not quite flat corners. There's a great thing on YouTube. Somebody has posted Eau Rouge down the years. Okay, so you can get into a car going through Eau Rouge in, 1990 or something. So over the last 30 years or something, and every year they've got on board of cars going through, and you can hear people braking. I think in the earlier they may be shifting down, and then they brake less, and then you can tell they're just lifting, and then you can tell that they're barely lifting at all, and then they're flat, and you can just see how the progression through that corner has, you know, been overtaken by technology over the last 30 years. That's what I want. I also like combinations. I love watching Formula One cars go through the Becketts complex at Silverstone, just watching them change direction, because I think when they're going really hard in one direction to immediately really hard in the other, that's where on telly, because telly slows cars down so much, doesn't it? That's where you actually get one of the greatest sensations of speed.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. And that's what they've done at COTA. They've sort of mimicked that Maggots Becketts sequence, haven't they?
Yeah.
And you get that same, even on TV, you can see how quickly they're changing direction and get a sense of how much speed they're carrying through there. The reality is it's not necessarily a circuit that's great for drivers is great for spectators. It's not quite the case, is it really?
I'll tell you what I think is the best spectator circuit in the UK, and you're going to think I'm mad. The Indy circuit at Brands.
Yeah, because it's a bowl.
Because it's a bowl and it's short. You know, there is somewhere you can stand where you can see the entire circuit. And love Silverstone though I do. It's a terrible spectator circuit. Because it's so flat, and you know, you can see the corner or two that you're in front of, and that's kind of it. Whereas the Indy circuit at Brands, you know, you never have to wonder what's going on because it's all played out in front of you. And I love, particularly as a spectator, that's a wonderful place to go and watch cars race.
Yeah, it's true as well with Liddon Hill, which is just a wonderful little track, isn't it? Used a lot for rallycross. And that's one of the great things about it is, you know, if you're almost wherever you're stood, you can see the whole thing and just watch a race play out, the whole thing.
Yeah,
and
exactly. It's really important.
You don't really need commentary or, you know, a visible sort of leaderboard or anything. You just watch the racing. It's fantastic. I think there's another topic that we want to get onto because, you know, it's all very well you and I sat here talking about which racetracks are great to drive, but... You know, the thing is, anyone can go and drive them, actually, because they're all open as... They all run track days. And as long as you've got a sort of vaguely suitable car, you can go and drive these incredible circuits. It's one of the great things about being, a petrol head, particularly in the UK, because our sort of circuit density is so high. And it's worth us having a bit of a conversation, I think, about... what it takes to start in track days, to prep your car, which circuits you should go to, and so on. Because some people listening will be desperate to get started and have no clue how to go about doing it. So what do you reckon? Do you think you just go to your nearest circuit, or should people be a little bit canny and choose a track that's not going to be too demanding?
I think there are very few things which reward a bit of thought in advance more than choosing the venue of your first ever track day. Because, you know, if nothing else, if it goes wrong, it could also be your last ever track day. And I'm not being morbid there. I think all I mean is that you're going to have such a crap time.
You wouldn't do it again, yeah.
Never to do it again. The other thing I would say about track days, and I know the track day market's gone nuts recently, because I think there are a lot of frustrated people out there who have been cooped up at home. And It's a really COVID-friendly way of, you know, letting off steam a bit, because you're alone in the car. And as long as you're a bit sensible when you're out of the car, you can just go and drive the nuts off a car around a track and have a great time. And, you know, it's not like you're standing in a big crowd of people. But anyway, so now I would really do your research. Look at the various tracks. Look at the various track day organisers. Do your due diligence. You know, how many people have turned up at a track with a really noisy car and discovered that they can't get on because it's a 96 decibel day? Or how many people have had accidents at track days and not realised that their road car insurance doesn't cover them. How many people have gone to track days thinking they'd just be able to go out and drive and find that in fact it's a session day and you're in session, you're in group B and you can only go on the track when group B is on, and on and on and on. There are so many aspects of track days. Also, look at the sort of cars that go to that organised. I mean, I was at an RMA track day the other day, absolutely amazing, but I was staggered by the kit that was out there. It was all top of the line, you know, Porsches and Ferraris and quite a few race cars and that sort of thing. And if you've just gone out and bought yourself a 1500 quid MX5 and are nervously thinking about doing your first ever track day, you don't really want to be out there with that lot. So yeah, also do not be too proud to have some tuition. You know, all the decent track day organizations offer tuition. It's not that expensive. It's like sort of like 50 quid for half an hour, and you should get to sit next to a bloke who is an ARDS instructor. So if you're ARDS, that's the whatever it is, the Association of Racing Driver, whatever. But that means basically they're proper. You know, an ARDS qualification is not an easy thing to get. And they are qualified not just to drive cars very fast, but how to teach other people to do it too. And you know what you'll find for that half hour investment, you'll not only have, you know, 10 times more fun than you would without it, you'll go much faster and you'll stand a much better chance of coming home with your car in one piece. So now I would set aside, you know, thick end of a day, I would really, really think about it and think about, you know, don't just do the lazy thing and go to the track that's next door or, you know, 20 miles up the road, because unless it happens to be the one you really, really want to go to, go somewhere you really want to go. Now, you might want to go to I'm just trying to think of a circuit that's quite central and quite easy to learn and not too, in somewhere like Mallory Park. Really nice, quite small circuit, not that many corners, not that complicated. You know, probably a very good place to go and have your introduction. Or you may just want to go and scare yourself witless, at which stage I cannot recommend Thruxton too much. You know, get down to Thruxton and God, you'll know you've had a day out after a day going around there. But just, you know, I don't think there's any right or wrong to it. Just, you know, just work out what you want from a day like that. And find the place and find the organisation that's best or most likely to deliver that for you.
There are still track day organisers who will do novice only days or novice sessions. Some track days are actually split into different groups based on experience, which is quite a handy thing. So you're absolutely right. Do your research and work out exactly what kind of day you're booking yourself onto. It's also, there's a lot to think about. You know, you need to make sure your car is properly prepped. You don't need a particularly special car at all.
No, not at all.
But you need your tyre pressures right. You need to make sure you're allowing it to cool down at the end of each session before you come straight into the pits. Silly things like you don't want to be putting the handbrake on. There's so much advice out there. You'll be able to pick up everything that you need to know just by reading around. But you know, there are silly things that might not even occur to you, such as at the end of a long day of track day driving, you're going to be exhausted. And if you've got 200 miles to get home, you know, that's going to be like hard work. I think there are some circuits that lend themselves more to the novice track day driver. The Bedford Autodrome is quite a good one, because if you hit something at Bedford, I think you get a plaque on the wall somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's a rare occurrence.
You can do it. I sound like I speak from experience. I promise you, I've never hit anything at Bedford, but I've come close and I've seen others do it. But no, you're absolutely right. It is. And there are lots of different circuits there, aren't there? And lots of different combinations. And yeah.
I've been onto the grass a few times at Bedford, but if you haven't, you're just not trying hard enough, are you? The other thing that we should address quickly is those track experience days. They do days at Bedford, don't they? But the thing is, we need to be quite clear about what sort of day we're discussing here, don't we? Because there are some where you pay 60 quid and drive a 10-year-old Gallardo for 4 laps and you can't do more than 6,000 RPM. And those days are pretty hopeless. But there are others. And the Palmer Sport days at Bedford are sort of among the best, aren't they? Where they really let you have a go in one or maybe a small handful of cars, and also give you tuition along the way.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the Palmer Sport days is, you know, with all these days, wherever you go, they always stick an instructor in a car with you because it's, frankly, their car. The difference is that with most other circuits, certainly where I've been, the instructors are there to slow you down. They're there to make sure that you don't overcook it. At the Palmer Sport days, they're absolutely there to speed you up. And, you know, I guarantee you end up going way, way faster than them sitting next to you than you ever would have done if you'd just been there on your own. And that's how you learn stuff, isn't it? And that's how you have fun. But, you know, I also appreciate that, you know, there used to be a company called Mithril Racing down at Goodwood, which, and they had some amazing old stuff. They had some classic Astons and that sort of thing, you know, quite not fragile, but delicate stuff, I guess. And, you know, and at a circuit like Goodwood, where if you come off the circuit, you pretty much have had an accident. And that's very much just about the experience. It's just, you get to drive one of those cars, and okay, you may not get to drive it very fast, but at least you've driven it. So again, it just comes back to decide, you know, there's so much choice out there, isn't it? There's so many tracks, so many different sorts of experiences. There are companies will just lend you cars, not particularly special cars, but if you don't want to go and rag your own car around a track, there are other companies you can go and rent cars from and you can rag their car around a track. So, you know, there's almost nothing you can't do. You might struggle to get in a modern Formula One car, but short of that, you can go and drive single seaters, you can drive sports cars, you can drive tin tops. Yeah, there's literally, you can choose what you want to do. And that's why I said at the top of this, how important it is just to do your research. One thing I would say, if you're thinking about doing your first track day in your first car and you've got perhaps, you know, a slightly elderly car that you bought quite affordably, it would be worth just getting, you know, someone you know, a local mechanic with, just to do a what we call a spanner check, just to make sure that, you know, the wheel bearings are up for it, the tyres haven't got any bulges in them, that, you know, all the suspension is nice and tight, the front tracking's not out of whack, and just, you know, a tiny bit of basic maintenance, which isn't going to cost you an awful lot of money, but, you know, will massively increase your chances of having a good day, because, you know, you don't want to get all the way over there and then just discover that, I don't know, a wheel bearing goes on lap one, and that's the end of your day, and you've got to, you know, and it's, you know, drive the car out onto the road, call the AA, pretend it's broken down there, and go home in a truck. It's not much fun.
Exactly right. I think there's some good advice in there. Well
there
done,
go. DN does thing. Consumer information. Who knew?
We won't make a habit of it. Oh, for the avoidance of doubt, we haven't been asked by Palmer Sport or paid by Palmer Sport to say anything nice about their days. That was a sort of honest recommendation from us. Do you know, it's a year ago this week that I collected my Alpine.
Uh-huh.
And it's never been on circuit.
Hang your head in shame.
Do you think I should?
Yes, absolutely. Of course, I had.
I thought you might be understanding, but no, okay.
No, absolutely. No excuse. I had one which Alpine kindly lent me for a little bit because it was a left-hand drive pre-production car, which I think France forgot to ask for back. And I went down and did a day at Thruxton in the wet in it. And in the wet, I mean, the boys were out in their, you know, in their massively fast Porsches and Ferraris and that sort of thing. And I'll tell you what, the little Alpine in the wet just drove rings around the mall. It was fantastic fun. So, yeah, definitely, but only if it's wet. I get the sense you're trying to wrap this up, so I just need to ask you one question.
Go on.
Favourite UK circuit?
Favourite UK circuit? It's
the end is nigh. You've got one track day left at one circuit in the UK. Where do you go?
Brands GP.
Oh, okay, excellent. So you've gone for a gradient and slightly scary.
Do you know? Let me tell you something good. That was the first ever sprint race I did, and only the second ever race that I did was in a mini challenge, in the mini challenge on the Brands Hatch GP circuit.
Yeah.
And that series is now the BTCC support series. That's quite good, isn't it?
That's quite good. Yeah, and quite a baptism of fire for you.
Yeah, exactly.
I would go for... I mean, my heart will always be at Goodwood, always. I just absolutely adore the place. But actually, just for fun, just for pure... I mean, Goodwood still scares me slightly, and it's quite serious. But just for fun, I'll go Donington. Donington, to me, has that great combination of... It's got some really challenging, as anyone who's driven down the Crane & Curves will know, it's got some really challenging bits on it. But there is usually somewhere to go if it goes wrong. And it's just got a lovely combination of, it's got everything from, second gear chicanes to lots of medium speed stuff. It really flows, at least one properly fast corner. And also if you get there early in the season, because it's parked next to East Midlands Airport and it's had avgas dripped over it all over the winter, it's incredibly slippery. So you just go sideways everywhere.
I've also done a mini challenge race at Donington, which was fantastic. And there was a moment mid race where coming down the Crane & Curves, as it goes round to the left, I went around the outside of the car in front of me and then did him on the brakes on the way into the old hairpin and got past. And I was so busy congratulating myself, he came past me at the next corner.
We've all done it. We have all done it. But I bet you had a laugh doing it.
Super.
I just love Donington. I think it's, to me, it's that kind of, it is a compromise between everything I want in a circuit. It's fast enough. It's visually, it's very pretty. It's actually, it's another good spectator circuit, actually, because it's got so much gradient. That's what you need for spectating. You need dimensions. The combination of corners. It's very centrally located, so it's easy for almost anyone to get to. And it's actually, it's very rare you go to Donington and don't see great racing.
Yeah, exactly right. Okay,
and we're not being paid by Donington either.
No. We should be, really, shouldn't we? We're horrible at this from a commercial point of view. Okay, all right. Well, let's wrap that one up. Racetracks. God, it's a good topic that we could probably do that all over again. There we go. So thanks everybody for listening. Thanks for downloading. Really appreciate it. Please do remember to check us out on Instagram at DriveNation_ and on Patreon as well. Patreon.com/DriveNation, and you can bung us a couple of quid a month if you want to in return for some exclusive content. Last thing, please rate the podcast and leave a little review for us. It makes a big difference. And we'll be back next week to talk to you again.
Yep, look forward to it. Thanks everybody.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.